Welcome to the TEEP podcast, brought to you by the State Energy Conservation Office and UH Energy. We bring you the latest in industrial energy efficiency in 15 minutes or less. Hi, I'm Gary Gildert, the director of the Texas Industrial Energy Efficiency Program here at the University of Houston. This week, we're going to talk about the presentations at the SPTC. We also had the Energy Day last week. It was a fantastic event. You can read more about it in the newsletter and on the UH Energy site. Coming up is the Cougs for Energy Hackathon on November the 21st and 22nd at the Student Center South. The Energy Coalition will also have their Energy Talk series on campus. Actually, I had an event about a week ago. It was fantastic. It was very, very interesting. Also on tap are the SPEER webinars. The SPEER webinars, there's a link for that in the newsletter. Next up is our intern, Hisham. He's going to talk to us about some of the presentations he saw at the Southwest Process Technology Conference that took place last month.
Thank you, Gary. List a few of them here that were, you know, very, very interesting. We had the one from Dr. Brian Rasmussen from Texas A&M University. He talked about a low-cost intelligent diagnostic for industrial equipment. He talked about how you can leverage what he called the industrial Internet of Things. And he emphasized how in the past we've had major industrial revolutions, major changes to the industry. And today's world, we have a cyber-physical system revolution where we are going to be implementing the cyber world with the physical world to improve and make things more efficient.
So that was a lot about the technologies, sensors, little gadgets that are attached to equipment for better monitoring?
Yes. Whenever we started, one of the biggest things in the Industrial Revolution was the steam engine, right? But of course, since then, we've made a lot of improvements. And in today's world, these improvements mean that you have to make things more efficient and on the smallest scale, make sure that you're not wasting any energy or any water that you may put into a system.
So this is part of the information age. If you can measure it, you can control it and save a little bit of energy.
Especially with growing demand, this is more important than ever. The next talk we had was by Bill Hicks, who is a principal sustainability process engineer from ExxonMobil. He discussed the ExxonMobil's energy fleet program, which helps to improve the biggest energy recycle part of any process, which is the crude preheat train. As you heat up things, you have to preheat it. You don't want to just go from 0 to 300 Kelvin in, you know, one quick, swift flow. But once that product is heated, you want to have it recycled through heat exchangers, as the heat exchanger is one of the major parts of the energy efficiency to not waste any heat and to not waste the energy that you've inputted into your system. This energy fleet program will optimize your energy usage, which could mean improving the duty on each heat exchanger, whatever way is necessary.
You know, that talk ties in really nicely to the one we had at the Energy Forum a couple of months back, where they talked about their fleet monitoring. But in that case, their fleet was their fired heaters. So now they're talking about their crude preheated systems and what else?
And then also the steam systems as well.
Right, yes.
Because steam systems are also very useful for helping to get that heat transfer. And, the preheat train consists of the multiple heat exchangers. That's, again, a lot more heat transfer that can be improved by a lot. And Exxon has their program that they advertise to be able to do so for many more crude plants.
It's a great program that they have because they can compare one site to another and essentially bring best practice to all their facilities. Good on them.
And then we have our next talk from a couple of Black and VH engineers. It was from Andrew Shaw and Prachi Selikar. They are both chemical engineers, and they, discussed how we can improve industrial wastewater treatment to make it more efficient. As we know, water demand is pretty high, and it only grows. And especially with our use of fresh water, it becomes more and more important to more efficiently have clean, available water on a consistent basis, not only for, you know, municipal use, but also for industrial use. So they talked about the different simulation tools they had, where they were able to make the parts of wastewater more efficient, such as aeration, distillation, and pumping, and reducing any kind of energy waste that comes along with having to clean out the water.
Now, it's funny, those of us who were never that involved in water treatment back when we were chemical engineers didn't think about using simulations for water treatment. That must be simple. No, this is the complexity that they get into is tremendous now, and it's nice to see that they have these tools.
And that complexity comes especially because water has to be as pure as possible for us to consume. That quality you cannot neglect in any way. So people do underestimate how many things are in water and are so easily soluble that is not easy to just simply grab out of the water.
Yeah, you dealt with some of that on your last internship, did you not?
Yes, absolutely. At Hartree Refinery, I dealt with the wastewater plant, and I saw firsthand just how much the water pulls out from the crude oil. All that nasty stuff, you can't just dump it back in the water. You kill the fish.
Don't kill the fish.
Yeah, we do not want to do that. You know, it also, that water ends up getting recycled back into municipal areas. So that's why we have to do our best to filter that out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
what was the last talk that you saw there?
Yeah, our last talk was also about water. It was addressing PFAS and water supplies. This was by Ramanathan Ganesan, Corey Smith, and Sumil Komineni. They were, all three of them are from Civitas Engineering Group, and they presented the many strategies for PFA removal, and again, through energy efficient treatment technologies. Very important to be able to do that because PFAs are not easy to get out. So of course it takes a lot of energy, especially if it involves heating up that water to leave those PFAs back behind.
Yeah, there are multiple, and it was nice to see that they showed multiple ways of removing PFAS from water. I thought it was quite interesting. They showed their little setup for testing different carbons, in fact. So it's good to see some practical field work there as well as just theoretical.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is only made possible, which they emphasize, through not only the public's health, but also federal programs to be able to do this more efficiently, because this isn't just a, you know, USA problem. This is a worldwide problem that we should all be getting together to solve, because water is how we live every day and it's how we continue to grow as a society.
Absolutely. So it sounds like there were some great talks at the Southwest Process Technology Conference. Fortunately, we were also able to record some of these. So watch our website and we will soon have some the video recordings and the slides available as well. One of the things we do here at TEEP is we watch the literature, look at what's interesting, look what's new, what is the best in industrial energy efficiency. Part of that is we have our interns scour the literature for interesting articles. Carla, you found a really interesting article that fits in with industrial energy efficiency. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, so let's start off by asking ourselves, why is converting CO2 to CO such an important challenge in our context? CO2 is one of the most stable molecules out there. It doesn't easily react or break down. Once it's in the atmosphere, it tends to stay there. And converting it to CO is valuable because carbon monoxide is a key building block for producing fuels and chemicals. It's part of a process known as syngas, which is a mixture of CO and hydrogen. And this can be turned into methanol, synthetic gasoline, and even plastics. This process lets us recycle the carbon dioxide into something useful. It's essentially turning waste product into a feedstock.
Right. Yeah. carbon monoxide, the history of using carbon monoxide goes way back, at least 100 years. And you're right, chemical engineers and chemists have learned how to use carbon monoxide. So to turn CO2 to carbon monoxide is a, it's an important chemistry, I agree.
So there are two routes of making carbon, converting carbon dioxide to carbon monoxide. There's a traditional thermal route, and there's an electrochemical route. So let's talk about the traditional route first. This is called the reverse water gas shift. It's been done for a while, and it's usually at high temperatures between 500 to 900 Celsius. And it's very energy intensive to produce, while on the other hand, the electrochemical route, it uses electricity directly. So you, to split CO2 into carbon monoxide and oxygen. So this means you can potentially run this process at overall lower temperatures, and you'll have higher selectivity.
So the selectivity comes from the fact that the thermal route, it's kind of messy, isn't it? Because not only do you have CO2 in there, but you have to add a lot of hydrogen.
Yeah.
And you don't make just carbon monoxide, but I think that, your review article talked about making methane as well, and you can even get methanol when you're just trying to make carbon monoxide. That sounds pretty messy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it, for the traditional route, it has a lot of side reactions. While I was doing my research for this paper, I talked to Professor Abdelrahman, and he put this into a different perspective, which is flipping a coin, where for here we have really two alternatives. You flip it twice for the electrochemical route. Well, for the reverse gas shift, you'd be flipping the coin a lot more often.
And when you're flipping the coin, you're never too sure which way it's going to turn out.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a lot of probability. And based on the Nature paper, it reports 90% efficiency and 100% selectivity. I ask you, in your opinion, how realistic are those numbers in the industrial setting?
You know, that selectivity number just might be right, because it is such a simple chemistry that they're doing. They're just stripping oxygen off of the CO2 molecule. Now, selectivity-wise, yeah, that's probably right. But I think we both agree their efficiency might not be right, because in order to push the reaction forward, you really need a bit of voltage over potential. And that's where you lose it a little bit. As you pointed out, though, on this chemistry, because it takes place at high temperature, that heat that's generated, at least it's high temperature heat, and that's useful.
So I talked in detail about this on our article, and we also talked about the stability of the catalyst that they did 2,000 hours of operation, which is a key benchmark.
This is interesting. Let me comment on this two ways. One, that 2,000-hour test, that's a good start. It is a really good start, because you can disqualify a catalyst through a test like that, because some of the samples that they showed did not even last that long, where industrially 10,000 hours or more is the expectation. The second part of that is interesting, of why is a stable catalyst better? Well, if you're going to have the catalyst online for the same amount of time, a more stable catalyst will maintain its selectivity and its efficiency for a longer period of time. And it'll maintain that higher efficiency on average better if it's a more stable catalyst. Really comes down to that at the end.
Yeah.
Excellent. So thank you very much for finding this article for us and doing a thoughtful review of it as well. So that's it for this episode of the TEAP podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks and talk about industrial energy efficiency for 15 minutes or less.